right. Good afternoon, everyone. How's everybody doing? Last day, how's that feel? Feels good, don't it?
It hurts.
We're going to go ahead and get started. We have one panelist who's not yet arrived yet, but we only have an hour, so I'm sure he'll be here shortly, and we're just going to go ahead and get going. Real quickly, my name is John Harris. Been brewing for many years now, and last couple times I spoke before you, this is the 16th time I've done this panel at the conference. It must be a record for longevity. I was 34 or something when I started doing this, so you've watched me gray if you've come to this through the years. But anyhow, there he is, Chad. Welcome, just on time.
Excellent.
Oh, you're right on time, man. Are you John Mallett? Side jokes are bad. I hope John's not here. Anyhow, it took a long time, but recently I opened up my own brewery, the Ecliptic Brewery in Portland, Oregon. It took about a year and a half to get open, but I'm glad to say to you guys today that I'm open and we're making beer and things are going good. So proud of that. We've been doing, talking about troubleshooting problems in a brewery. I'm going to ask our panelists here to introduce themselves in a second and give us their ideas of how they troubleshoot problems in their breweries. But I really like to take a approach with my brewery about using our senses, using our sense of sight to make sure our brewery looks right. There's a certain thing way you want to keep your brewery, make it the way your brewery wants it to look. Is the tanks clean? Are the hoses coiled the way you like them? Minor things like that. Does your brewery sound right? What is the sound of when the chiller turns on or the air compressor, which sucks? But how does your brewery sound like? Sometimes if you just get to know how your brewery sounds, you might notice, that pump sounds weird. Of course, taste is the favorite sense we like to use in our business. And does your beer taste right from the start to finish? Does the wort taste right? Does the hops taste right? I hate tasting hops, but I do believe it's good to sip hop teas. And then your sense of touch with the grist. Does the grind feel right in the mashing process? And, of course, the sense of smell, which we use daily. Just does the brewery smell right? Does the wort smell right? Does the beer smell right? And I think that, for me, that's the approach I like to take, using all my senses and getting to know my brewery in and out in that kind of fashion. So what I have to do now, and I'm just going to warn you now, this is a Q&A panel. So after we do some little introductions, we're going to call on you to ask us some questions. And we're going to ask you to come to the mic at the front of the room. And don't be shy. I know it'll start slow and gather great momentum as we get going. So I'll start here with Chad. So it's about you to introduce yourself, tell us where you're from, what you're doing, and give us a few tips on how you like to troubleshoot problems in your brewery. Everything's live.
Yeah, it is. As well. I'm Chad Jacobson, head brewer at Crooked Stave Artisan Beer Project. Our brewery is very much focused on barrel-aged beers and using wild yeast and bacteria. So a lot of the troubleshooting and process for our brewery really happens on the back end. So a lot of sensory, a lot of paying very close attention to the nuances between different barrels and characters and beers, and being able to try and keep quality within the creativity, but also product that continues to be consistently quality.
I'm Matt Brennelson, the head brewer, brewmaster for Firestone Walker Brewing Company. So we're a mid-size regional player. We're not completely nationally distributed, maybe 9 states full book and another 5 or 6 states with partial book. And I guess we're a pretty standard issue brewery, but we do have a barrel program, actually 3 barrel programs. We do oak fermentation, so primary fermentation in oak. We started that right out of the gates in 1996 when we opened. So it's an obligatory piece of being a brewer at Firestone. You must work with barrels. In fact, that will be the very first thing you do as a brewer for Firestone Walker. And I always say at my interview, I thought it was all smoke and mirrors. So in my interview, I said, yeah, what's up with that barrel thing you always are advertising about? That's all smoke and mirrors, right? And they're like, no, we really do that. And I'm like, well, there was no 101 fermenting in oak class at Siebel, so we're not really going to do that when we actually distribute beer outside of the Central Coast. And they're like, no, we will. I'm like, well, we'll use oak chips or something like that, right? And they're like, no, you will ferment in barrels. Man, it's a non-negotiable part of being a brewer here. So we had to figure out how to do that in a non-pasteurizing, non-sterile filtration brewery. So I'm here to tell you it can be done. It doesn't always work out perfectly. Then we have a second oak aging program that we started about 10 years ago that's primarily using spirits barrels. And again, non-pasteurized, non-sterile filtered. And then, of course, we succumbed to the urge because of folks like Chad here, and started a sour program. And in fact, our quality manager, Jim Crooks, who's been with us for 12 years, completely went 180, and instead of protecting the brewery from Britannomyces, Lactobacillus, and Pediococcus, he went to the other side of the moon and now makes all of his beers primary fermented with Britannomyces and secondary fermentation with Lactobacillus and Pediococcus. So he's no longer allowed in the brewery. Not in the main brewery.
Human down the building.
Yeah, we opened a second facility about 90 miles away from our Paso brewery in Buellton. And yeah, he has not come to Paso, so that's a good thing. And then on top of that, I guess we keg. 50% of our beer goes into draft, 50% is bottle. And then we just recently installed a can line, and so that's a new endeavor for us.
My name is Tom Dargan. I am Director of Brewing Operations for Gordon Biersch Brewery Restaurants, and I oversee 35 breweries from Taiwan to Honolulu to the west coast of the United States to the east coast of the United States to the southeastern United States. So my job entails putting out an awful lot of fires. Before coming to Gordon Biersch some 16 years ago, or 14 years ago, of course, Gordon Biersch is very German lager, primarily lager focused, although we do some other things. And unlike most brew pub systems, we do step mashing and capping fermentation and all those fun things that German breweries do. Before coming to Gordon Biersch, I worked for John Hickenlooper, that wacky governor guy we heard the speech from this afternoon, or yesterday, whenever that was. It's all a blur. Opened a bunch of brew pubs for him all over the country as well. So I will state at the outset that I am the least educated and probably the dimmest member of this panel, but I have made every mistake you could possibly make and had to find out a way to fix it. So hopefully I'll be able to add a little bit of real-world advice to this astoundingly astute group here. And my philosophy as far as troubleshooting goes is just that. Don't be afraid to admit you don't know something, because if you take that tact, if you're afraid of some other, you know, super smart brewer looking down on you, you're never going to learn anything, and you're going to keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again. As a piece of that is collaboration. I mean, this conference is a great example of the value of that. I hope you're getting some value out of that yourselves, with all the people that you talk to over your 18th beer and you can't remember the cool thing that they were describing to you from the night before. But not just inside of, you know, we have 35 brewers, and so usually if you've got a problem, someone else has had a similar problem and found a solution for it, and if not, there's, you know, a huge community of folks who are surprisingly willing to help out, even if they're competition. So
I'm Grady Hull. I'm assistant brewmaster at New Belgium Brewing Company. I've been with the company for about 18 years. We have a 240 hectoliter brew house, a 120 hectoliter brew house, and a 10 hectoliter brew house. We do all kinds of different size fermentations. We have two centrifuges. We do filtration. We do non-filtered products. We also have a wood beer program. We do lactobacillus souring as well as mixed bacteria souring, and normal packaging stuff. So.
All right. Well, who wants to kick it off with the first question for this esteemed panel? Thank you.
Rod Murray from Public House Brewery in Rolla, Missouri. I'll ask the big question that happens with new brewers. What do you do with the stuck fermentation? Still tastes great, smells great, stops halfway done.
You can all answer.
So I don't think I can actually use the name of the method that we've employed or we've learned at Firestone Walker. I'll just call it the donkey kick. We'll call it the donkey kick.
Donkey punch.
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's a phenomenon. It happens in every brewery. There's always this process of going through your notes. So I think first and foremost, you know, good record keeping goes a long way, obviously, to solving these problems. So going back to your malt analysis, mash temperature, rest, all of this type of thing. So once you've exhausted all of that and haven't found it, you still have a stuck fermentation, right? So, you know, a number of things, making sure temperature is correct, all of those things. But what we end up doing is we take some very healthy, viable yeast into a small mobile tank. It's about a 10 hectoliter tank. And then cool wort in. So it's like an exaggerated prop, essentially. So we're trying to generate new yeast cells and get some yeast that's in that phase where it's just getting through growth phase, so through hycroizin. And then we jettison that or pump that into the tank and make sure we mix it well. And that has been the greatest success that we've had. And I think that, you know, what I always say is be proactive. Don't wait another 24 hours or 48 hours to see that it's still stuck. You know, I think there's a difference between stuck fermentations and slow or sluggish fermentations. Both are the case of poor yeast health or some other physical issue, temperature-wise or other. So we take a really progressive approach. You know, we know where the gravity should be day one or 12 hours in, 24 hours, and we're taking gravities every day. And if we see this thing exhibiting stuck fermentation-type symptoms, then we donkey kick it. Yes, that's what I call it.
Just to sort of tag on to that, we do something very similar. We'll put fresh, healthy yeast into a tank, a clean tank, and then move the beer into the yeast. But then, as Matt pointed out, the most important thing is root cause analysis so you don't do it again. To figure out what went wrong to cause the stuck fermentation.
Yeah, I think brew pubs sometimes don't have the option of having a lot of other tanks and whatnot available. It is cool if you can move the whole thing into another tank and you have, you know, another beer that you can get fermenting to do that with. And the old adage is the first thing we always say if someone calls with that problem is, you know, have you tried rousting the yeast with CO2, try turning the temp up a little bit. And then finally, I mean, in a brew pub situation, it's probably a small batch. You're better to shit can that batch of beer early on and get another one going than you are to think, oh, maybe it'll work out all right.
Yeah, for us it's kind of similar where we have a small amount of fermentation, sometimes just one going on at a time because it's either in fooders or in a smaller fermenter. And I think that's the way it can be for newer, smaller breweries all the time. You might not have another beer. If we have another beer, I like to try and, this is one of the big reasons we like to try and stagger fermentations. If I do have something else that's going and it's in krausen going, you'd be able to push a little bit over to see how it's doing. Or, you know, just simply trying to rouse the yeast and maybe get it back up in suspension. Looking at maybe a cell count and seeing, okay, where would you be at? Why is it different from where your other fermentations normally are? And trying to kind of work on, you know, what yeast health issue might have happened kind of all along the way.
And one more thing I would add, something that we've got back in the habit of doing, and it's easy to fall out of this habit, but forced fermentations in the lab. So making a concentrated, once again, viable yeast cake so that you can over-pitch a small sample of beer, say 500 milliliters in an Erlenmeyer flask, throw it on a shaker and force that fermentation as far as it'll possibly go, and then compare your finals to that. And that's a critical step that I think a lot of brewers forget to do. It's one of the simplest assays that a lab can do for you. And then you basically learn something about your malt crop, you know, new crop year, do force ferments, see where that's going, checking your mash profiles against it. Maybe you need to, you know, lower some mash temperatures or something like this. So, you know, it's just another piece of the puzzle in quality control to make sure that you're on top of those fermentations.
Steve Gonzalez with Stone Brewing Company. So very open-ended question. And this is a perfect panel to ask this question to. I'm dealing with an off-site warehouse with a barrel program hauling beer to and from the facility. Sometimes the final destination is that warehouse, and anything with some funk in it will be packaged off-site. Also, some high-end bottling is done off-site. But occasionally, some beer comes back to the brewery, and it's sort of a whole nother set of variables when transporting beer back and forth. So I wonder if you guys could share some of the troubleshooting stuff you've done with the transport.
Everything that we do is transported. So currently we still don't even have our own brew house. We're getting that up and going. We've worked with kind of multiple breweries from Fort Collins down to Denver. And what we currently have set up that works really well for us is to be able to produce wort at a brewery that's just a mile or two away, to be able to push the wort into stainless steel tanks, and then we're able to bring that up to our barrel cellar and push that in. We're adding yeast in line and starting fermentation there. I like that from the standpoint that, you know, while we're really concerned with oxygen all the way through the process, but wort is the place where we tend to oxygenate it to be able to get that oxygen in for cell growth, yeast health, and a sustained fermentation. When you're moving finished beer, it's something that you really, especially when we're talking about beers that have Brettanomyces, beers that are going to be aged in oak for a while, you have to look at it in a little bit of a different point, because we are making beers that are going to be in oak for 3 months, 12 months, 18 months. Oxygen is a part of that process. So you have to kind of realize that, yeah, while we're being able to ship it, and while, you know, we're really looking at minimizing oxygen content, the yeast that we're using when you're using Brettanomyces is a yeast that's really antioxidative. So it really protects the beer. It's quite nice. If we were talking about, you know, we're brewing our IPA over here and wanting to transport it over, it really wouldn't be an IPA at that point, because most of your flavor characteristics, oxidation characteristics, hop characteristics are going to be drastically changed. So it's a nice process being able to work with Brettanomyces yeast specifically for this. I still just, you know, it's kind of that dogma of a brewer and thinking about oxygen, prefer to move wort than finished beer, but as we move forward, we'll be moving a lot more finished beer. And it's really relying on, again, treating the tote that you use like a bright tank, getting that purge on it, getting the beer in there, and getting it into a barrel where you have Brettanomyces specifically, but also Lactobacillus does a good job. If you think about a lot of beers that age 3 years, 2 years, 1 year, oxidation in a sour beer is not the first thing that jumps out at you, and hopefully it's not really ever what jumps out at you. Yet that beer has just spent however many months in a barrel aging, where oxygen is constantly being influenced. So it's a different way of definitely looking at the beers and the way they get produced.
We just recently got into transporting wort more than beer, actually, for our BarrelWorks program. So as I stated, it's 90 miles away. We're very fortunate that in wine country where we're at in California, winemakers, you know, they're moving bulk liquid all over the place. In fact, there's a whole bulk market for wine. So a lot of times when winemakers have a batch that can't be used in a blend, or they overproduce, they'll sell it on it's a commodity sell in the bulk market. So we're lucky there's a bunch of stainless steel tanker trucks that move up and down the Central Coast all the time. So what we started to do, maybe long story short, we started by doing the entire primary fermentation in Paso Robles and then trucking beer down, or barreling it down and moving barrels. And as we got more and more comfortable with moving bulk liquid, we've gotten to the point now where we just cool into the truck, which saves a lot of barrelage space in our production brewery, and then pump it into the fooders or barrels down at BarrelWorks and actually inoculate down there. I really like doing the inline pitch into the truck if we're trying to produce something that's not funky, for instance, or just, you know, going to be Brett treated later down the line. But we've gotten really comfortable with just bulk transfers of wort. And then maybe another part of your question was just this, what do you do with, you know, or philosophically moving or having funky beers alongside your clean beers, and Grady can probably talk more about this. We basically just keep them separated at all times. Those two liquid streams never come together in the production plant. I'm probably way too anal retentive, but we've done a few Brett fermentations in our brewery only because the guys let me do it once and they won't let me do it again, kind of thing. So,
pass.
We also have a wood beer program. We have a wood cellar. When the beer is ready to, you know, we taste the beer when the beer is ready to be processed. The first thing we do is run it through a flash pasteurizer, take it up to ADC for 12 seconds, and make sure that everything's dead before we move it into our cellar. Once everything's dead, then we can move it around our cellar without worrying about it. But when we put it into a tank, we hold it in the tank until we get micro results. So that we know that it's safe to move it to the rest of our cellar. But in, like, La Folie, for example, I mean, it's already been aged, it's already been soured, and the bacteria is no longer alive.
Can I add something to that?
Sure, do you want to go there?
I just want to say that we did the Hop on the High Sea series, so we're actually shipping a lot of not finished beer, but post-fermentation beer, and we had a lot of issues. We're shipping in a 200-barrel refrigerated, super-insulated container. And we found the only way that we could effectively produce our DO levels in those containers being shipped 1,200 miles from Puerto Rico to Florida was to fill the entire container up full of sterile water, push it out with nitrogen. So that might be another thing to think of if you're shipping in containers like this.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to get in the business of moving bulk beer like that, definitely, get a DO meter. It's probably the most important tool you could have, so you can start watching that really closely. And we use a gas purity meter to test the purge on a vessel like that. But yeah, you can't overstate how important it is to purge those vessels out. Any bright beer tank, yeah, treating it like a bright beer tank for sure.
Hey, thank you. Thanks, Wayne. Go ahead.
My question kind of was already answered a little bit, but I was going to ask you, you guys have a DO meter. If you guys have a problem with dissolved oxygen on the packaging side of things, how would you assess and pinpoint a dissolved oxygen problem?
What's the package?
Bottles or kegs.
With bottles, there's kind of two things. We usually we measure the oxygen on the bright tank, and then we fob the bottle before it gets filled. The bottle gets evacuated and filled with CO2 three times before the beer is put into it, and then it's fobbed before it gets capped. So we have pretty low DOs because of that at packaging. But another thing to think about with bottles is if you have a hard crown. If the seal is hard in the crown and you're stacking your pallets, three pallets high, when they compress, sometimes when they unload, the harder seal caps don't uncompress as much, and so you get higher DO pickup. I think that the thing people talk about is one part per billion per day, but that can be even higher if you're stacking them three high in your warehouse. As far as kegs go, we check our seals when we receive the kegs. I don't know if you guys have more to add.
I just think, in terms of good housekeeping, our brewers, especially in the cellar, are just focused on DO control all the way through the process. So, the goal is zero, and we try to stay in single-digit part per billion from step to step. So anytime we're venturing above, say, 15, 20 parts, we're critically analyzing and walking the line and making sure that we don't have leaks, all of the obvious things, replacing valve seals on a regular basis, all that kind of thing. Another trick that we learned that works really well is we do a hot sanitation of the filling equipment. So we completely pack the system 100% with ADC water or whatever the supplier is recommending your highest temperature can be. We recirculate that for 45 minutes on packaging day. So we're CIP'd the night before. We're hot sanding the day of the run. Then that hot sandy line has a glycol heat exchanger on it so that we can take the whole system back down to beer temperature while it's still packed. That liquid is essentially zero oxygen at that point. So if you don't have a deaerated water source, that's a good way to go. And then that system's pushed out with CO2. Beer is brought into the system. We fill the beer, the bowl 100% with beer, then push that to the drain, then prime the bowl and go. And then we run one rotation of the line, and we do TPO on every valve, basically, or as many as we can afford time-wise on that particular run day. But that packing the system and pushing it out and then watching DOs all along the way. If you know what you're transferring to the filler, hopefully you can keep it under 50 total parts. It's like ignorance is bliss, and then you get a DO meter, and then you get a TPO meter, and suddenly where you thought you were running really well, you learn really quickly. So you really need to have the meters and the way of doing analysis along the way to really improve the system.
One more thing I want to add. We had a product that was lower, it was only about 2 volumes, CO2, and we had to increase our fob water pressure almost 5 times to achieve the same DOs. So if you're having problems with your bottles, that might be one thing to look at is your jetter water pressure is a variable you can adjust to get your DOs where you want them.
Go ahead.
Hi, Jace Martiaga, Shell Brewing Company. And Matt, you kind of touched on it a little bit. What kind of procedure protocol are you guys doing for startup and filling and even like shutdown the night before as far as lab microplating and stuff like that to ensure that your filler is clean before you start running?
A couple things that I really like. Packaging is all about time, and time is money. And we've gone to a program probably more similar to what New Belgium or some of the larger breweries have now, where we dedicate one quality control technician to the packaging run. And that way, you know, I always love putting quality in the hands of the operators, but packaging operators are so busy at the beginning of the run, it's really important, I think, to have that support network and having a quality technician who's just focused in on that. And, you know, slow it down if you have to. A tool that we really like for assessing a quick assessment of micro is the luminometer. So ATP testing is really effective around the filler. You get instant results, then you give instant feedback to the operators. But we're also doing, you know, traditional swabbing and plating every day as well. So, you know, there's a delayed response, so to speak, but at least you have a history of how your filler is. And, you know, as far as just troubleshooting on the micro side, for us anyway, the crowner, you know, the crowner is the enemy. So, you know, we go to work on that thing daily, hand scrubbing, ATP testing and plating constantly around the crowner, and that tends to be the area that lights up the most.
Yeah, I agree. I'm a huge fan of hot water because it gets, like when you use chemicals, it can't get behind the seal wherever the rubber is touching the metal. It can't get behind there, but heat can, because if the metal's hot, it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to get to it if it burns it instead. So, yeah, we use heat a lot, and especially in packaging. We use, same thing with Matt, we use traditional plating, but we also use PCR for our bright tanks to clear our bright tanks, because it's a little bit faster, with a lot faster results. But, either way, I mean, usually with your schedule, when, you know, you can't just hold the bottles forever. I mean, by the time you get results back, they've probably already left the building, so there's that.
You know, and just maybe to answer your question a little more thoroughly, I think a proactive approach is always the best. So we actually, we're in not in a perfect situation where our filler is actually a little faster than our labeler. So we can run up to an accumulation table, build some accumulation, and then almost hourly shut the filler down for just, you know, a couple of minutes. And we have a CIP system in place where we can hose down the crowner especially. And any stall time on the filler, we're on it. You know, we're either foaming it or scrubbing it down. So we take advantage of any downtime to clean. And that way, at the end of the night, when everybody's tired and wants to go home, you're not just, you know, doing all your cleaning in one section of your shift, which is probably the worst time to try to do it.
Go ahead.
We're getting ready to commission a large vertical candle filter, and the brewery that we purchased it from had tanks that were able to receive kind of the dregs after filtration, and then they'd blend it back. We're trying to get away from having a bunch of blending tanks, and we're kind of thinking we are not going to go with deaerated water. We're going to pre-coat with clearish beer off a racking port, and then drain the unit down, trying to push it through a plate and frame. Anybody have any experience with getting it's a 70 square meter, so it's got a 30 hectoliter or larger capacity of finished beer that's going to be stuck in there. So just wondering how the best way to get that out of there is.
We do have a candle filter, but we do it the way that the previous brewery does it. I mean, we just brew to a higher gravity and more hops and everything like that, and that knowing that it's going to pick up some dilution on the filter at the beginning of the run and the end of the run get collected and blended back in the middle of the run. It's kind of the way it's done.
And that's and you go into you have deaerated water that you're flushing everything through, and then a tank that gets the blend at the end, and you blend that back in, or
so. Yeah, you use the deaerated water to get the DE on the candles. And then you start bringing beer in, and it start the run. But the first stuff, the first liquid that comes through is obviously going to be a lower, diluted beer. Goes into a tank, and then once you get up to gravity, you start going to your bright tank and slowly bleeding the diluted beer back in. In order to do that, you have to make beer that's higher concentration from every standpoint, the hops, malt, everything.
Is it completely crazy to try to do a pre-coat with beer that you're bringing off a high port?
I don't know. I've never tried it.
Okay.
I'd be lying if I said I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know if we have a relatively small filter compared to that. That's a monster you got. That's a big filter. We have a 20 square meter, and it's a vertical leaf filter. So we are able to pre-coat, prior to having deaerated water, we would pre-coat in, you know, stabilized water, essentially city water, but treated water. And then once we got the pre-coat on to the screens, we're actually able to press that out with CO2 and empty the filter, and the DE actually stays on the leaves.
Yeah, I think that's the problem with the candle. It'll just...
Yeah, I'm not sure if it'll stick on a candle. Yeah. So, I mean, it may be worth a try. And then Enduron, we do the same thing. We press the beer out with CO2, and we don't get 100%. So, I'm not sure if that helps.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'm Ben Knudsen with AC Golden Brewing Company. We've had some trouble with our lager fermentations and not hitting target BDK numbers. We've looked at yeast health. We have good yeast health, and we've looked at manipulating zinc on the brew house side, looked at magnesium in the malt. And I guess still we're still kind of stumped as to what we need to do. Same with monitoring oxygen. And if you have any other questions or anything else I can be looking at to improve my VDK numbers other than making my lager an ale.
So some of the things that we've had success with, using zinc for yeast health is good. Also, we've had sort of at the end of fermentation, what we sometimes call secondary fermentation, increasing the temperature on the tank to allow it to get through its VDK rest faster. But also just time. I mean, it will get there. Just make sure you drain off the dead yeast, and it's sort of yeast strain dependent, but time.
Yeah, that's. I mean, obviously, we don't have all the detectors and tools that all you guys have. But when breweries have issues with diacetyl, a lot of the time it's just they're just rushing. And we used to have a protocol that I think it was primarily because we were wanting to get good volume of yeast out faster to drop the temperature of the tank down to like 4C, get some yeast out, and then let it build up again. To let's say like 8 or 9, and then that protocol let it sit there for like 4 or 5 days. And I think of the paper that that was Tony did from Coors a couple years ago in it was either San Francisco, I think it was San Francisco or Chicago, one of the two. I mean, he was pointing out going that period of time had to be a lot longer, or the temperature had to be a lot higher. And since then, that's kind of what we've recommended is, plan your schedule so that you're able to, allow your diacetyl rest to be a lot longer than, just a couple days.
In our, in the lager fermentations that we're doing, we're kind of fermenting at a little bit warmer temperature, a little more neutral flavor that we're getting out of it. But because also we're not, kind of crashing and producing the way a lot of other people would be doing their lagers, we send it to a tank with Brettanomyces in it, and that tends to really help reduce the VDKs.
All right.
I hope none of my guys heard that.
That's going to be his answer for everything, just add. I don't know that I have a whole lot more to add to that other than that. Recently, I mentioned that Jim Crooks left our brewery to go to Barrel Works, and when our new quality manager came in, she was really focused on yeast health, and we thought we had really good viability. We thought we had really good yeast practices. Our fermentations were getting to the finish line. Diacetyl in general was pretty good. So, we have a GC, we're watching it. We know we were within our, our spec. And then, she really went to task on making sure that our dyes were fresh and at the strength they're supposed to be when we were doing our viability assessment, added a few more tests, kind of changed some of the protocol on propping, and guess what? VDKs started to be reducing more quickly. Viability was hanging on higher in the brinks. So I think sometimes we look at our procedures and we say, well, everything looks good, and then you kind of do a little more refresh in your yeast assessment. And I don't think you can ever have too healthy of yeast. I'm sorry? Well, we're predominantly an ale brewery, so I'm trying to think, as far as lager beer, we're trying to harvest that yeast as soon as we possibly can, and we're assessing viability along the way. We're pretty progressive in reprops on lager. We'll only go a couple generations. We kind of have that luxury because we don't brew a ton of lager beer. And Yeah, I mean, the time thing, but, you know, time is money, so we're always trying to get to that finish line as quickly as we possibly can in terms of diacetyl. So I guess at the end of the day, I would say just reassess how you're assessing viability and make sure that everything is as tight as you possibly can. And then you already mentioned zinc, you know, kind of the magic bullet. When we added a little bit of zinc, we saw diacetyl levels, you know, drop down considerably as well.
One last thing I want to add. The time thing is a double-edged sword because you have to wait for the VDK to drop, but if you have a very long fermentation with a very long VDK rest, that harvest will probably be a bad fermentation, which will be even longer. It'll just do it again. So the time isn't like the silver bullet.
Thanks, guys. Go ahead.
Actually, kind of going on that point, so we're a relatively new brewery that does about 50% lagers. We do have lagering tanks, but kind of the issue for us has been trying to get the most out of our lagering time and lagering flavor while also not running out of stock on kind of those flagship lagers. So I'm wondering if you guys have any techniques in terms of, you know, slightly higher lagering temperatures tend to work a little bit faster, or you've found more success in we haven't quite got the nuanced lager flavor that we want as well. So we're trying to balance kind of, again, time and quality at the same time.
Well, I mean, we're very traditional, and we're sort of stuck to a contractual obligation of going a full 5 weeks. But again, I would look up that paper that it was Tony, right? Anybody know the paper I'm talking about? The talk I'm talking about that happened, that he was talking about brewing great lagers in like 18 days. And all my guys are sitting in there like, oh my God, I mean, is pitching a lot more yeast and, you know, fermenting at like 18 degrees. And I had some of the beers they made there were pretty good. It's all stuff that scares the crap out of me, but I would recommend looking that up and doing some experimentation to see what might and what might not work for you.
This is pretty basic, but what I did, I just went to the shop and got a piece of copper pipe and bent it, and we store it in lactic acid, and we put it in a swing link when we hook up a tank for a chiller run or a filter run, and that usually takes the sulfur down quite a bit because the beer has to go very turbulently through the copper, and that will take the sulfur down pretty quickly, if you don't have the time.
I know a lot for lager fermentations, the yeast, so... You know, you talk a little about the yeast source that you use, and especially with the flavor. I think a lot of brewers can really be really picky about what they're getting out of their lager fermentation, what they're getting out of the characteristics of those beers. And I've watched a lot of brewers change lager strains over and over again until they find the one that they like. We do actually lager quite a few beers. They don't get finished. They go for the other thing. But the flavor profile is really important in how those finish out. And so we looked at different strains that we're using and looking at fermentation temperatures as well, because the idea for us is that we're trying to produce a clean beer that's fairly neutral, still has a nice characteristic, you know, in as short a time as possible. So different strains are going to do well at different temperatures. So it's kind of maybe, you know, reassessing your program, how it looks, reassessing maybe the yeast, if that's a house character that has to stay, or if there's something else that maybe you can look to go to that does a little bit better at around, you know, 10 degrees C, and, you know, after a week bumping it up to 12 for that little bit of a diacetyl rest and being able to get it off, but still being able to attain some of those characteristics you're looking at, or, you know, what in your process is the time, but going back to the source of the yeast and its characteristics and how you perceive those and how you work with that yeast.
Yes, go ahead.
My name is Brendan McGinn with Plowshare Brewing Company from Lincoln, Nebraska. I was curious what could be the possible causes of a high or super saturation of CO2 in a beer that's kind of winding down fermentation, usually day 4 or 5, and you're taking a gravity reading, and it looks kind of like nitrogenated beer, super tight foam. You know, this usually is like the 4th through 6th generation, maybe a sluggish ferment. If you've experienced anything like that.
Do you have pressure on the tank when you're...
No. But it just seems like you get, like, pour into a keg cup or something like that, tight foam, and then you put a hydrometer in the flask, and it just is releasing an amazing amount of CO2.
It's always like that, or it's...
No, it's a rare occurrence. It just seems like the CO2 hasn't evolved out, I guess, and it's kind of a rare.
Always in the same tank, or?
No. Yeah, I can't quite figure out the commonality. Malt? But in terms of maybe yeast health or under or over oxygenation.
You know, obviously if you're taking samples during active fermentation, you're going to see a lot more CO2 in solution. Obviously you're supersaturated. So to me it just sounds like, you know, you're catching that sample in fermentation.
Yeah. But in like with established brands, when you kind of are expecting, okay, we're winding down, it's day 4 or 5, a week earlier it wasn't like that. So I'm wondering if maybe if it was an underpitch, yeah, then maybe it just needs an extra couple days.
I think my answer for just about everything is assess yeast health, and yeah, you can't have too healthy a yeast, and that may be a sign of, you know, any sluggish fermentation is a sign of poor yeast health at some level, and I would just really concentrate on that. And
thank you.
Obviously, a gushing, if it's a gushing problem, it could be a mold problem with malt. I mean, that happens.
My name is Evan Lewis, Agger Brewery, Norway. My question has to do with water. Unlike probably a lot of people in this room, we live in a tiny little town in western Norway, so the idea of city water is what runs out of the mountains upstream of the sheep. So we're really fortunate. It's not chlorinated. It's not treated in any way. We have the world's most pure, wonderful water. It has to be acidified for the light beers. It has to have minerals for the darker beers. But we've always got in the back of our heads, what if something goes wrong with the water supply? Since there isn't any serious treatment, it's not being chlorinated. What if the city changes something on us, doesn't let us know? We've been thinking, should we have some kind of sediment and police filter in place? And recently we had a little scare because there was a power outage and all the city pumps shut down. So the water backflowed, picked up some sediment, and then flowed back in. And we'd finished heating up 120 hectos of hot liquor, only to find out that it was mud, and we had to dump the whole thing, sip everything, and start over. So we don't want to get in that position. What should we be thinking about for water treatment? We don't want to go RO. We don't want to intensely filter. We don't want to change the basic character of our water. We already know how to work with it. So if you have any suggestions.
Well, one thing that kind of saves all of us is that the vast majority of the water in brewing is hot. So the chlorine, kind of regardless of where you live, is reduced dramatically. We do carbon filter on the cold side water, but that's you know, less than 10% of our water. Most of our water doesn't need carbon filtration because it's taken up to 80 degrees Celsius in the hot liquor tanks before it goes into the mash or sparge. So that's kind of a saving grace, which also, that high temperature also reduces carbonate, so you're kind of saved from hardness there too. So it's sort of a non-issue. Also, the tanks, you probably have a receiving tank or a hot liquor tank. They end up being sort of settling tanks. So if there is some debris, it usually ends up on the bottom of the tank. We open ours up every once in a while, and there's always, you know, there's sediment on the bottom always, even though water looks clear when you get it from the city. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I was going to say, I did a brewery in Mazatlan, Mexico. Let me see, my son's 19. So it was 19 years ago. And when we first went down there, you know, the worry was, of course, oh, this is water in Mexico. What are we going to need to do to treat it? And so we got some samples and we ran them through a lab here, and everything we tested positive for, you know, you name it. You know, it was like it was connected right to the toilet. So, you know, we put in string filter, carbon filter, and then the biggest UV light you've ever seen outside of like a commercial, like a water treatment plant. And you know, we never really had any problems whatsoever. It was probably more, you know, the giant UV light. Although I will say, the first week we were starting at brewing, I was like running around. This is a big nightclub complex and everything. I'm running around because we had a breaker go or something. And I go back to where the... This is a while ago in Mazatlan. Mazatlan's much more developed now than it was then. But I went back and saw the UV light wasn't on. We're in their first week of brewing. I'm like, oh, shit. And looked up, and someone had clipped the cord because they wanted the plug. It was really common for construction guys to just take cords off of whatever drill or whatever, and they took it right off the UV light. So get a UV light and make sure no one clips the cord off of it.
I think just what we actually... filter our water pretty intensely, and I'm a big fan of RO, but in your case where you don't want to go to that, I think a simple carbon filter is a nice thing to have no matter what, in case there was a chlorine issue or any kind of flavor issue of any sort. The UV is really nice too, and that would be a simple one to approach that could really save you in the case of some kind of flash of debris. Simple sand filters are also something, and then just make sure you get in a good regiment of back flushing that unit, depending on the amount of water you're putting through it, whether that's a daily back flush or a weekly back flush.
So we're in Denver, and we originally started brewing. We were up in Fort Collins, and worked for another regional brewery up in Fort Collins. And Fort Collins is gifted with having amazing water. Really, really nice. Never had any kind of problems with it, very little to do with it. It's pretty common to not filter your water at all in Fort Collins. And we moved down to Denver and all of a sudden started getting chlorophenolic characteristics in our beer, which is pretty weird because we always brag about having such great fresh water in Colorado. Turns out the wonderful city of Denver likes to use chloramines in their water, which are hard to get out. So because of the way our yeast reacts with that, we got to put in a nice, very large charcoal, carbon filter and load that up. And we have to do that in order to get the chloramines out of our water just to be able to brew clean beer, which seems really weird being here in Colorado. I always think we have such great water. And so it's kind of taught me that having stuff in line to be able to, be able to see every once in a while what's coming through. So where I kind of always blindly thought, oh, we have great water, everything's good. It would be easy to say, well, talk to your water official, see what's coming through, but it just doesn't work that way. You get spikes in sulfur sometimes, you get spikes in chlorine sometimes. So to have even just a carbon filter in place that, for us it has to have a significant amount of sitting time, holding time, in order to pull those chloramines out is very important. But to have that, and to be able to kind of see in line, just teaches you a bit more about your process and where things are coming through. Tanks definitely work well, settling tanks, so if you're opening that up and looking at it, you are seeing what's coming through in the bottom. But also having that filter and having it back flush and keeping it going, it's just another kind of eyes, another set of eyes on the floor for you to be able to look at and to be able to understand more about your process and what is coming in, especially if things could be changing.
Yeah, I kind of forgot about chloramine. If your city water has chloramine, then what I said earlier about temperature does not apply. You have to filter it.
Sadly, it does not.
And, you learn it in brewing school and you forget it, but you need to taste your water every morning before you brew. First thing you do when you get to work, get a glass of water.
First thing I do every morning.
Period. Everyone.
Oh, my God. You can taste a lot in your water. Probably, sensory is a very big part of our brewery, part of everybody's brewery. So the easiest thing is to tell you, taste everything through the process, but beer being 95%+ water, the first thing is tasting the water. So even getting in and brewing, having a glass of water and see what it tastes like for the day. Our water drastically changes here in Denver a lot. It's a bummer. So tasting, that's a big start to the day.
Thanks.
Hey, my name is David Coyne. I'm from Fort George Brewing Company in Astoria, Oregon. There's a lot of people that are working with barrels up here, and it's a huge, broad topic. But if you could talk about a little bit, I guess, how you pick your barrels, how quickly you use them, how you prep them, and what sort of processes you go with along the way while it's aging in there. Even if it's a sour, I'm sure you want it sour in the way you want it to sour, not with acetobacter. So some of the ways you might stave that off, purging it with CO2, topping off the barrels, all that stuff. Thanks.
Mr. Closeness.
I got nothing to say. I can go first.
Okay. So we have the three different barrel programs. We could probably talk for hours on it, but just in general. So with the fermentation system, these are new medium toast American oak barrels. So, it depends on who you talk to in the industry. Hopefully they're micro free when they're received at the brewery. But everything gets 3 minutes of ADC water through a spray ball. Prior to any beer being added, that happens 12 hours before the fill, and we hit it with some SO2, so either a sulfur wick or SO2 gas if you can use it in your state is really handy. Then that barrel is purged with CO2 very thoroughly to get the sulfur out, of course, and also just good housekeeping before it's filled with fermenting wort. And then 3 days into the ferment, we take micro samples. So we get a couple days, at least 2 or 3 days of plate development. And then we deem the barrel fit to go forward after it passes diastole rest, which is typically about a 7-day process. So hot water in that program. Barrels that we use, the spirits barrels program, hopefully we're receiving barrels that were recently dumped, and it's good to try to check up on that, because obviously when barrels start drying up and you have leaking issues, you know that it's been sitting somewhere too long. So freshly dumped barrels, we assume, had high-proof booze in them. We've not had much in the way of micro issues with those, so they are just simply opened, purged with CO2, and kind of counter-pressure filled with finished beer. Then they're bunged up, and we don't touch them. A lot of people like to top up, and it seems like the more we handle them, the more prone we are to some type of microbiological contamination. We bring the barrels down 6 weeks before bottling. Every barrel is plated, anaerobic and aerobic plates. SDA and HLP are the two that we use. Sometimes MRS broth, if we think we're getting into some real issues. And then we get great, a couple weeks of plate development before the barrels are then blended together and pushed forward. So that's a completely clean program. I'll let you talk about the sour beer program.
For ours, we have, like Grady kind of talked a little bit about fooders. We have both sides where we have very large oak tanks, which we do both primary fermentation in with mixed culture, and large oak fooders as well, which we use for just aging beer, and it's kind of a cascading system down to smaller barrels. And being able to talk about the smaller barrels, I think, helps because it's what the majority of most people are using. So when it comes to working with mixed cultures, working with the beer in those barrels, beer that's going to spend, maybe even a minimum of 12 months in that oak, and really trying to keep the any sort of acetic acid characters to a minimum. Acetic acid is a very important part of a blend of sour beer, so it balances the lactic acid out and those ratios and where they are, and the depth of acids are very important. But definitely what you don't want is when you start getting acetic acid as high as you start to have vinegar characteristics. Brettanomyces will metabolize that into ethyl acetate, and you start getting more nail polish characteristics. So the process that we've really worked out that's really been working well for us is that we'll have a larger bulk beer aging in the fooders, which we're trying to really just keep with Brettanomyces, start to develop the characteristic, get that a flavor characteristics we're looking for. And then they move into smaller wine barrels, and that's really where we're trying to do more of the acidic fermentation that's happening. So with lactic acid bacteria, both PDO and lactobacillus, and a plethora of probably other cultures that are in there now, and spending a little bit less time in those oak barrels, because what we're looking for is when we just have one fooder of beer, we just have that one base of beer. As we're able to move to smaller barrels, we're able to have more to be able to choose from to blend with. So if we do have an off barrel, it doesn't matter. We can get rid of it. But really, in having them in the shorter times and then processing them through. So the process, which our brewers love because it takes way longer than 12 hours to do, is that we'll be emptying barrels. The minute a barrel is being emptied, it's turned over, and with warm water, hot water, HLT water, getting the spray ball inside, and we're getting rid of everything inside. At that point, a lot of that yeast that's dropped out and is at the bottom is dead spent yeast cells with its Saccharomyces, Brettanomyces, Lactobacillus, and Acetobacter. There's a chance that Acetobacter would sit on the top and didn't get really into the barrel too much, or that it started to get to the bottom. So we really get rid of everything that's in the barrels. They get dumped, and then they're refilled the next day from the fooder. So fooder back into those, and we re-inoculate again. Clearly, we're not being able to clean out the yeast and the microorganisms in the smaller sour barrels, but we really are trying to knock it back to a point where it's negligible to when we then re-inoculate. And so we're always kind of keeping our house mix culture going, and we're always re-inoculating in those barrels. After a while, you definitely see diminishing flavors as the barrels start to close off. I would recommend, meeting a winemaker, meeting a cooper, or just some awesome brewer who teaches you how to take the heads off barrels and be able to scrape them. It's really important for the flavor development. And because of that, we really we don't get rid of barrels at all, and we just kind of keep them going. We're able to re-liven them. But the process is really important, so not letting them dry out, not letting them sit, re-inoculating them, not just hoping whatever's in there is going to kind of happen again, and then minimizing the contact as well. So once the beer goes into the barrel and we inoculate, you know, just forget about the barrel. Don't taste it for a while and start to learn about your process and your time. Not going and topping up, not pulling the bung, not sticking your nose in it, but kind of touching it as little as possible.
Our process on the wood beer, we brew it on stainless with house yeast. Everything's pretty much normal until it gets to the bright tank. And then we'll knock it out into the wood. During that time, the bacteria in the wood will sour the beer over 1 to 2 years. And the way we don't actually measure, we don't control the bacteria. We do it all by taste. If we, this is kind of a simple example, but if we like one barrel and we don't like another barrel, we'll dump the one we don't like and fill it with sulfur water, kill everything in there, dump the sulfur water, rinse it out with hot water, and then split the two so that we have the bacteria we want in both barrels, and then top them both up with fresh beer. So that over time, that's an oversimplification, but you get what I'm saying. Over time, you get the barrels tasting the way you want them to taste. But we don't actually plate them. We don't run micro on them. We don't even know what's in there because it's a blend of stuff. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Oh, as far as the wood thing, you can, because we're sort of committed with the fooders. We're sort of committed. If you need a barrel to produce more wood flavor, you can, when it's empty, spray it out, get in there, and scrape it. It's not awesome, but you can do it.
Definitely not awesome.
And you can send barrels back to the cooper to have them, you know, retoasted and everything like that. Sometimes it's maybe more trouble and cost than it's worth, but it's an option.
Okay, we're definitely winding down here with time. Go ahead.
My name is Brian from Bravery Brewing, Lancaster, California. My question's two parts, pretty straightforward. It's about sulfur. It's about preventing sulfur in the final beer, and if you do detect heavy, offensive sulfur aromas post-fermentation, what can you do besides from just, I guess, blowing CO2 through it? That's what we've tried to do to try to blow off those volatiles.
We use CO2 to blow off sulfur, although that has a downside because you can also lose other aromatic components. I'm a big fan of copper, like I mentioned before. The only thing with copper is you want to keep it in lactic. We use lactic acid to keep it fresh because if it gets kind of a patine to it, it stops working. What's funny is the lactic acid turns green. The copper stays pink. Time, obviously. The other thing we've monkeyed around with is... at the end of your fermentation, take it down to, if it's a lager yeast that's causing the sulfur, take it down to like 5 degrees or so, 4 or 5 degrees Celsius, so that you have a not quite dormant aging period, which might speed up your sulfur reduction. The last thing I would mention is, obviously, if you're using a lager yeast, don't make sure you're not using any gypsum or adding any elemental sulfur.
Go ahead.
My name is Chris Johnson from Green Bench Brewing Company in St. Pete. I had a quick question. It may be based mostly on climate, but we have an oak fooder where we do primary fermentation of all our Belgians in back home. It has a stainless steel coil on the inside, so I can run glycol to control fermentation temperatures for primary. We also have a temperature-controlled cellar room right now. We're looking into getting like a dehumidifier for it just because it's so humid back home where we are. So my question would be just process on taking care of barrels. You can have some mold issues pretty quickly back home where we are. It's not as much an issue on the fooder because I find that it's mostly all that temperature controls from the inside out, so I don't really get, like, doesn't really sweat, doesn't really have much moisture on the outside. But when I put it in a temperature-controlled cellar room, the difference in the temperatures outside and in causes some sweating pretty heavily. So just want to know what maybe your basic cleaning barrels is.
Quats are good for mold.
Sorry?
Quats. Yeah. Cool. They last, and they're good for mold.
Cool. Just don't get into contact with your beer.
Yeah.
But I think you're on the right track. I mean, dehumidifying that room is great. I cannot remember the name of the product, but many winemakers use a treatment on the outside of the barrels that's antimicrobial, and I don't remember the trade name. But if you contacted a wine supply, it's basically a topical. We use that on our fermenting cellar just to keep micro down on the outside of the barrel.
Right. Okay, we'll go ahead and roll at time, or we'll go ahead and take one last question. So go ahead.
Thank you.
Brett from the Wild Beer Company in England. We've got some pretty astringent grogging laws, which if you add spirit to a beer, you're grogging, so you're raising the ABV, and then we get taxed as a spirit instead of a beer. And tax is already shit. We do a fair amount of barrel aging, and have you guys had any experience of trying to get the uptake of ABV from an ex-spirit barrel down? Like some steam heating it or washing it, but yet trying to still retain the character of the barrel and the previous use. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, we tend not to do too much in the way of rinsing those barrels, but I have found with certain spirit producers will rinse more or less. It just so happens Heaven Hill, who a lot of us get barrels from, doesn't do a very extensive rinse of the barrels. We found that Four Roses barrels, we got a lot less alcohol pickup because those barrels were very heavily water rinsed. So I guess my suggestion would be maybe a cold water rinse. You don't want to get too gnarly with hot water and strip a lot of the beautiful flavors from the barrels. So maybe cold water rinse would be my first approach.
All right. Well, thank you for your participation in the panel. And thank you, panelists, for your excellent answers. Thank you. Cheers.
Well, so yeah, I just took